Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. It's been an interesting week, but I am so grateful to be able to be here this evening and with our guests. And this is the third program in a series that Heart Talk with Miss E has been doing to address the issues of sexual abuse, primarily childhood sexual abuse, but abuse that has continued or maybe even just happened and one's adult life. In the first week, we had Ms. Winsome Alexander, the editor-in-chief of Outspoken magazine, who shared her personal story of abuse as a young child up through adulthood and some of the emotional and behavioral issues which impacted her life after that. And then the following week, we had Dr. Brian Post, who's a child expert in dealing with childhood trauma, especially in their areas of adoption, along with additional guests who goes by the name of the Zion Poet, a young man who shared his personal experience of being experienced sexual molestation at a young age. However, that call came out as somewhat different than what we had anticipated, but we still were able to explore the dynamics and the impacts because it's my personal belief that a lot of what we see in the acting out of our adolescent and young adult males stems from that trauma that is even more socially inhibited for them to discuss. And today we have a guest who, of course, her title and her work just is right in alignment with mine. They call her the Healed Heart Worker. And actually, that's not accurate, but my note just disappeared. But I met her through a referral from one of my Platinum Speaker colleagues, Annabelle. And this lady, I looked at her website. We had a chance to chat. She sent me her workbook, which I owe her another book in return. And it's just beautiful and awesome. And I have a place in my heart for creativity and art and music. And I think she has really hit the nail on the head. And her name is Miss Rae Olin Luskin. She is the author of Art from My Heart. And she is the director, and I'll let her tell you the program because my note just disappeared. But Rae, are you there?
I am here. Hi. I'm so glad to be here, be able to talk with you and your audience and share a little bit about my story and why I do the work I do in the community. I've been blessed by an experience that changed my life. You know, that's how I look at it. It wasn't always easy. I was abused as a child by my grandfather. My parents were actually clueless and couldn't read the signs. You know, I acted out in numerous ways, which I know you've addressed in many, you know, instances. You know, my mom used to, you know, brush my hair every night, and one night I told her, "Don't you ever touch me again." She never asked me why. You know,
Let's tell the audience about your program now. What is the name? Is it Soul?
It's Survivor Soulutions, S-O-U-L.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And I love that because it's like, you know, my
principles. Yeah.
Based on words with hard work. You're talking about solutions, which meaning problem solving, but it's about the soul, that it goes deeper than just the outward appearances. And when young people have experienced trauma that impacts them on the inside, just as you had already started to tell, that people don't have a clue of what's going on just from the outside, so we have to look into the depths of the soul, and that's why I like the heart and the soul of a person, and I really appreciate your putting that up front.
Oh, so thank you. You know, when I ask people to point to themselves, you know, if you take a moment and you point to yourself, you usually don't point at your head. You know, most often you sort of put your hand over your heart. You know, mm-hmm. and because that's where we live, you know, we live there. That's where our soul resides. And so, you know, as you've adopted the heart everywhere, that's how I feel. The heart is the soul of us. And I do believe that no matter what our wounds or traumas, there's a place in there that is healed, whole, and perfect just as it is. And sometimes we just have to find it and go back. And that's why I talk about solutions rather than just, you know, solutions, because that's where it is for all of us, I believe.
Yes, yes. So I cut you off because I wanted to make sure that people are aware. I like to come full circle. I like to say where we are now, then go back around and come back to full circle, because what people are, it's important for people to hear is that, you know, people say survivors and I say conquerors, because your process of surviving that you now have come in the process of conquering all. And that
I
you
love
do
that because I think you're right on, because I've never liked the word survivor in that sense, because mm-hmm. it's limiting. Conqueror, mm-hmm. you've conquered it. So I love mm-hmm. what you just said. That's wonderful.
Yes. So how old were you when you started to be experience sexual abuse by your grandfather?
I was 7, 8, somewhere around there. It was an interesting time because he was an artist, and so was I, and I had won an art contest, and he was so proud of me, invited me and my sister back to his art studio, which became sort of a regular Saturday afternoon event. And, you know, so we were, you know, sitting on the couch, you know, and he'd have one of us, you know, at an easel and the other be sitting on the couch, and then he'd say, oh, let me, you know. You know, we'd be talking, and he'd be asking me questions about me, which, you know, is part of the process, the grooming process.
Grooming.
You know, and I felt like I was the most important person in the world, and he really wanted to know what I was thinking and feeling and what, you know, whereas no other adult really treated me that way. You know, we'd play cards, we'd talk, you know, and then he'd have, oh, let me give you a back rub, but back rub always ended up a lot more than a back rub, you know. And so it would be so, and then when he was finished satisfying himself, he'd get up and he'd give me this cut crystal candy dish, and he'd say, take your candy, but it's a secret, you know, being the secret mm-hmm. implied it's a whole lot more. And he'd get up and he'd go wash his hands, and then he'd have my sister and I switch, which was really sad experience. And
older or younger than you?
My sister was younger than I was. And
okay.
So she stopped going to his studio a lot sooner than I did, because it was a love-hate relationship. I hated what he did to me, but I loved the attention. I craved the attention from an adult. You know, I didn't get it at home. And, you know, that's some of the issues that we don't want to always admit, you know, and then it's like, yeah, but I really liked being somebody paying attention to me, you know. And,
right.
And so it was a love-hate relationship in that sense. And I got so much because I was an artist, and, you know, he'd also help me with my painting and all that kind of stuff. And it went on until I was like 13, and to this day I know exactly when it ended, and it was so clear. It was interesting. He had come over. I was painting a portrait of our dog as a gift from my mother, and he comes over and he takes the paintbrush out of my hand and he starts painting over my painting. I burst out screaming, "Don't you ever touch my painting again!" And he never touched me again. Isn't that interesting?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
What do you think it was that abruptly stopped that? What was it in that interaction?
I think I stood up for myself. I think he heard me say no, you know, that I was strong, that I was at a different place. And it also could be I was just getting a little too old for him, you know. So I'm not quite sure either or both.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think because I wasn't the sweet little thing who would just listen and do whatever he wanted, I think that was the end of it.
Right. So in some ways that probably even startled him, and he knew that you were willing to speak out. And that's, you know, has been our theme about, you know, and with the magazine that Winsome Alexander has is Outspoken, and the DVD that I put out with Dan Smith is called Break the Silence. And so
right.
even though you didn't tell at that particular point, you spoke out. You gave voice.
Spoke out, and he knew. You know, I mean, there was a strength in me that was never there before, you know, that what was private, what was mine, including my body. And I think that just came through very clearly to him.
Wow. So you were 13 at that point.
Right.
Did your relationship in general, you know, on the surface change with him, like with amongst other family members and
I can't say that it really did change with him. You know, at that point, they stopped being in our lives pretty much. They moved to Florida most of the year, so I only saw him on occasions at that point. I grew up in Chicago, and so they just moved away, and so there was very little interaction at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was partly that. The family dynamics, the sad part, my sister blocked it all out. She didn't know I was in the room, and I didn't tell anybody. I finally told when I was like 21, you know, I knew I was in serious trouble. I'd had, you know, as you've talked about with other people, you know, the repercussions are endless at times, you know, between, you know, the emotional, the depression, the sadness, the, you know, all the other things. I gained weight. I'd either be isolating in my room or I'd be acting out in really, you know, poor behaviors, risk-taking and things that were not appropriate. And, you know, so I finally at 21, you know, I was a senior in college, and I knew I had to do something because I was writing desk poetry every day. I knew I was in trouble. And so I came home, and I went into therapy for the first time. And
wow.
I didn't really tell my family until I was, a few years after that, probably 23, 24, I told my mom. And then when I was like 26, I told my dad. And when I told my mother, my sister said, it happened to you too. And I've been carrying this guilt around forever because I was supposed to be the older sister protecting her. And she wasn't even cognizant that I was in the room. So,
And that's one of the other things about breaking the silence. You know, I've shared with others. When you speak for yourself, you free someone else to speak out too.
Right,
and
totally.
I've
been trying this year to get people to come out and talk. I've started this campaign, 100,000 people to come forward in whatever manner it is to break your silence, even if you just say one word, or if you're further along in the journey to really to do something different with it, to write a poem, to paint a picture, something that takes it out of you and puts it out there where it really needs to be, because it isn't your fault. You're not guilty of anything. You shouldn't be ashamed, which, unfortunately, most everybody is. So.
Right. I'm curious, and then we're going to move on, you know, to the healing aspect. I have a couple of questions about your parents' response. However, when you were saying, you know, all these risk-taking behaviors of depression and the weight gain and all of that, what were the underlying messages that were, you know, hanging over you or just lurking inside of you? What were the messages that you had about yourself?
You're worthless. You're broken. No one's going to love you. You're unlovable. The shame and guilt, you know, you did it. You didn't stop it when you finally knew. You know, in the beginning, I didn't know what was going on. I was a kid, you know. I had no way to know this was not normal. And then when I did, then I was shamed because then it was too late to tell. You know, I felt like, who'd believe me? He's a pillar of the community. You know, why would they take my word? They're going to say I asked for it. You know, so all those things come up. And it's all that confusion and feeling helpless and hopeless. You know, it's like, is this ever going to change? Is the pain going to go away? I mean, we spend so much time in our head. We've created these stories, and they feel real, even though they're not the reality of the situation.
Exactly. And that is so important. And even the whole thing of waiting to tell, I've heard people say, you know, well, it's over with now, or how's it going to help, you know, anybody, or the whole issue. And especially, I think, one of the biggest conflicts that has come up that I was so glad that one of our guests addressed is that when you become at a certain age and your body starts to respond to it, not realizing that that's what your body is programmed to do. That's what it's developed to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're a sexual being, yes. And you can't not respond. And then there's all the confusion around what's normal, you know. And then pretending. I mean, I was a great little actress because I played the most innocent, naive person you ever would meet because I didn't know what else to do, you know. Mm-hmm. And people would be embarrassed to tell a dirty joke in front of me because I seemed like this prude, you know. And that was like I had to pretend I knew nothing because I knew everything. I mean, as a senior in high school, we had to write a paper, you know, this thesis. I picked the history of syphilis. If that wasn't a cry for help, I don't know what was. You know, it was like, okay, I'm talking about stuff I had no business knowing about. You know, I didn't have a boyfriend, any of those things. But there was just this total disconnect from my family saying, what is that? I don't know what she's doing, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, look back. Wonder, you know, how often did you really try and cry for help without actually saying the words? And I think a lot of people do that.
Yes, exactly. What was going into therapy like? And I'm sure when you went in, you did traditional therapy. How was that helpful for you?
In the beginning, I did traditional therapy, but I was so scared and ashamed. I didn't talk and I was very shy then. You wouldn't know that now if as you talk to me, you know, I just like to chatter. But I didn't say a word for 6 months. I went into group and individual at the same time. I didn't say anything. And I just sat there, and finally one day I said, Gramps used to give me chest rubs. And that was like the start of my coming out and telling these stories, you know, and what my life was really like. And I was in traditional therapy for probably almost 12 years. You know, I got healthy enough that I got married. I would go periodically into therapy, and then I stepped back. I got pregnant. I went into therapy immediately. I thought I was going to be an abusive parent. I broke the cycle. That was not the case. But even with my second child, the same fears just overwhelmed me. And, you know, about being a mother. And would I perpetrate upon them? And so I kept doing that. And as I got into my marriage further on, as I said, what happened was I realized I was never happy. You know, I mean, I looked happy on the outside. You know, I had all the trappings of a good marriage. I worked part-time. I, you know, took my kids to activities. I volunteered. But there was always something missing. It was sort of like this gray fog that sort of descended upon me. You know, yes, there were moments. I mean, I was in a really, you know, as I started going through this and realizing something was really wrong, I felt like I lived a lie. And that sent me into a tailspin of a depression. And for like 6 months, I barely could get out of bed. I mean, I'd get up and I'd say to my kids off to school, I'd crawl back in. And how I started to come out of that was I started writing 3 Didwells and 3 Gratefuls because that little piece of that was my sanity. So that was the beginning of
audience. The Didwells and the Gratefuls, because some people may not quite catch that.
Okay. I would start a journal that says, I am grateful, and write down 3 things every day you're grateful for. It could be, you know, you got out of bed, the sun came up, you have a roof over your head. It could be as simple as, I looked outside and I heard a child laugh. Whatever that is for you that makes your heart sing and you can start opening up to joy and happiness or even just a faint smile on your face, think about some memory if there's something in your childhood that was beautiful. Maybe it's a song you heard at church. Maybe it's something on the radio. You caught something that made you laugh on TV. I think it's really critical to keep that
list. And it did well.
And the Didwell is, I got out of bed. I brushed my teeth. It's more about self-care. When you're in that state of depression, you don't care about yourself. You know, you don't want to shower. You don't want to eat. Or maybe you overeat or whatever it is. And so it's like, what did you do that day that was good for you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or even good
and
for somebody else.
Acknowledge every
right.
piece. Energy every step because someone said, well, that's what you're supposed to do. And I think even as children, and I talk about doing that with our inner child, as children, if you're not given motivation and validation for what you've done, you don't feel like, you know, there's nothing to go on for. And so
right.
I think the fact that we give ourselves credit and say, you know, I'll talk to someone and say, what did you do today? Nothing. Well, did you get up? Yeah. Did you eat? Yeah. Well, good for you.
You know, did you pet the dog? Did you help take out the garbage? You know, what did you do that you should be proud of? You know, mm-hmm. and it may be you helped somebody. Maybe you mm-hmm. just smiled at somebody and said hi, and you don't know how that changed their day. And I think we need, as a society, to be aware of that, that a hug and a kiss and a big smile, hi, can change somebody's life, and we're not even aware of it. I actually, the first time I started talking about this, this woman comes up to me, and I was just telling her the stories about my Didwells and all, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "You just saved my life." And that was, oh, my God, you know, you just don't know by what you say, whether it's breaking the silence or sharing something of yourself, because you are a gift. Every one of us is a gift, and we have to unwrap it. That's how I look at it. We have to unwrap it. It's there. You know, we may have forgotten it. It may be buried under all these negative messages, but it is truly there. And this is our time to find out that gift of who we are. We're a treasure. And we don't necessarily know what are our gifts and talents, but you're going to find out, you know, and allow someone else to help you along the way.
Exactly, exactly. I read a quote this morning, and I don't see it, but it said something to the effect that just even speaking out about to clear out the murkiness in our own lives, that we think is just a confession, can end up being a profession to save many lives. And I love that because it's just being. Mm-hmm, it is. So 21, going to therapy, in therapy for 12 years. And so as a therapist, I know that there can, and having been in therapy myself and needing to go back right now, I understand that there are some aspects that are beneficial, but sometimes you reach a block and you need to do something more. So what was beneficial in the traditional, and then what took you onto your new journey of healing?
Okay, I mean, obviously, I was a victim for a really long time. I mean, I suggest people, you know, when you can look back upon it. I mean, one day I sat down and started writing all the horrible things that happened to me. I said, what is this? I don't want to be a victim. You know, I believe healing is a choice that we make every day. And so I got to the place I was surviving. Traditional therapy got me to survive. I mean, like I said, I got healthy enough to have a family and children and to live a life that looked normal. But so, you know, and I had some gifted people along the way, I will say that. But I did. I reached that mountain, that wall there where I couldn't go any further. I couldn't get beyond just surviving. And I said, that's a sad life. I want more for me. You know, I knew there was something else. I didn't have words for it. I didn't have a vision yet. But I knew this feeling was not good enough and that I deserved more. And I think that was part of the gift of the healing was I deserve more, you know. And so I started on my, you know, my self-help, my personal development work, and that just took me in a whole nother 40-year journey.
Wow. So tell us, what was your first step to going within and pursuing the art from your heart work?
Okay. I think, you know, I started first with self-help books. The first one I got was Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Jeffers. The second one was Shakti Gwan's Creative Visualization. Those two just triggered something in me. Now, I'm the kind of person who I don't just read a book. I do the exercises. So I suggest people do the exercises. Journaling is beneficial, you know, and that was sort of the start for me. I mean, because there is a science behind it. You know, we're so left brain, and that when we have a trauma, it goes in our body first. This is how I describe it. You know, our amygdala takes it and transfers it through our, you know, up to our brain, and the left side creates words, good, bad, ugly, you know, all those things, judgments. And we live with those and we believe them, but there's still this stuff buried in our body. And so I think getting the right brain, which is journaling, writing, and art, takes us out of there. It can actually move it, change it. And so that's what happened for me. I started journaling. At one point, I probably had 100 journals. You know, I finally had to burn them. They took over my house. But I kept finding those books. And, you know, in between, I would go back to, you know, I tried everything. I looked for healers and shamans, and I went to all these 12-step programs. I tried anything. I was open. And I think that was my gift of being open to try what works, because not everything works for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have one therapist who said, why don't you draw your pain? And I'm like, oh, my God, aha moment. And I have to say, as an I am an artist, but I had shut down. Okay, I mean, when I went right into therapy the very first time, I painted a painting, and it was of a young girl, and the pain and anger in her face was so intense. I stopped painting for those 12 years of traditional therapy.
Wow.
So I just couldn't go there. I mean, the pain, it scared me. It was so raw and emotional, and it was like, oh my God, I can't look at this every day. So I was scared of it. And yet I hung on to it, you know. And so once I started to scribble, and that's all it was, I just picked crayons, whatever, what I was feeling, whether it was anger or sadness or grieving or whatever, I just picked crayons and I would scribble. And I'd use my, you know, my regular hand. But then I had heard about using your non-dominant hand. And because that accesses your right brain even more. That is like going to the soul of who you are. And so I would try and write with that hand and scribble with that hand, and just that's where I started. And it was just, and then it was like, oh my God, it became an obsession because I noticed a change. As soon as I started to scribble, I noticed, oh, the pain in my neck wasn't so bad. The pain in my, you know, leg wasn't so bad. You know, I mean, we have all those sayings about, you know, body parts and pain, and, you know, do you carry it in your jaw, your shoulder? Everybody's got some kind of tension and overwhelm and exhaustion, and we carry it in our bodies. And so I could start seeing how this just opened me up and changed everything because I got it out of me. I mean, that's the simplest explanation I can say. It was like, oh, my God, it really transformed it. It's out of me.
You know, it's interesting because here and there I've read about, you know, the dominant side, the left and right brain and the creative. And I've known myself because I used to be quite artistic as a young child. That got cut off, you know, and I think I hadn't done anything artistic since my freshman year in college until probably about 15 years ago, when I actually did an art therapy program, got a grant to do it with kids, and I started doing the work myself. And I was, you know, as involved as the kids were. And I so much believe that there is a connection. And when you were speaking of, you know, seeing the intense pain in your drawing, how it scared you, because that says to me the heart knows. And there's something that happens on a subconscious level that keeps us from going there because it's too much for us to partake of, but it's still within us. And so to be able to process that, and I believe that's why it has to be a process. People have to be patient, and I just can't stand the tone when people say, you know, well, just get over it. I cannot stand that. Because you get through it.
Work getting over it. I mean, on back of my Survivor Solutions card, I said the do's and don'ts. Don't say you should feel that way. Just get over it. It's your fault. Scold or shame anybody, you know? We've got to learn to listen to people and validate their pain and be patient with them and with ourselves, you know? There's a journey we all take, you know? And I do believe that we have to be, you know, we have to love ourselves enough to want to take the journey. You know, just like you said, it's scary. But on the other hand, I think the talk therapy at times can re-wound us. You know, if you get stuck in that story and you're repeating it over and over, it's not changing it.
Right. And I think to be able to speak it is a help. But even when I think about working with younger children who really don't even have words to put there, a lot of times when you're doing Santrate therapy or art therapy, you will find things, and even in just, like, you know, just some of the things I've done. It's like, that's why I'm so excited to be able to do this little experiential part today about the doodling, because I doodle a lot. And when I look at papers, there's certain things that just keep coming up. And I ask myself, what is that all about? And that's, I guess, the other question I wanted to ask you about, what are some of the other emotional and mental healings that can be impacted by artwork? Because not everyone has experienced sexual abuse, but there is usually some type of place in the core that's wounded, and there's a hurt and there's a pain that weighs people down and brings them back to a certain place sometimes. So what are some of the other areas where you've seen the art?
Right now you can find it, they're doing so much work in hospitals with cancer patients and people who are terminally ill. There's a hospital called Shands Children's Hospital in Florida, which is one of the first places where it's become part of the modality that doctors use. It is part of the healing because they realize there is more to healing than traditional medicine. So they take it a step further. It's about creating an environment of peace and love and joy, a place where kids can have some fun, where they can also find out, I'm okay, even if I have no hair. I'm okay, even if. You know, it's like, I am just beautiful as I am. And so that is out there, and that's been there, you know, for the last, 15 years or so. They've been really doing a lot of work. You know, they used to be like the idea of the Pac-Man eating the cancer cells. You know, a lot of it is what's going on in your mind. You know, we can do that. But the core of us, I think so many people are just wounded. And it can be as simple as somebody told you you were ugly or fat or you weren't smart enough. You know, how many kids hear that every day, and that beats them down? They carry that with them, and that makes, you know, them be less than who they can be. They're not going to shine in the way that they could because they have that little voice in their head saying, you're just not smart enough. Why should I go to college? Or I'm good enough if I just get C's. You know, they don't even try harder because somebody put it in their head that they're never going to make much of their lives. And that's the saddest part, because we are robbing the children of the opportunity to be the greatest they can be every time that somebody says something hurtful.
Yes, and they're re-wounded.
How many people have been told they're too fat, they're too skinny, you have four eyes, you know, who are you? You know, bullying. I mean, you know, it's like we haven't taught children how to be competent and caring and compassionate. And so with all that going on, it's so hard. And that's why I believe of using, you know, something as simple as scribbles, where there's no artistic expression necessary. You don't have to be an artist. You don't have to be talented. It's scribbling. You know, it will take you to a different place. And I always suggest that parents use that as a way to develop heart-to-heart communication with their kids. You know, you sit down with them for 10 minutes every night. Instead of telling a bedtime story, maybe you sit and you color together. It's an opportunity to talk. You might find out something, you know, or you can ask them, well, what do you feel? One of my favorites that I suggest to families and people in workplaces, when you are in a situation where there's more than one person, have a big scribble doodle board that, you know, or a big piece of butcher block paper, put it up. Everybody gets to scribble. So, and at the end of the day, make a game of whose scribble was it? What were they feeling? So the people start an opportunity to dialogue in a nonverbal way, and they may be more attuned to what's going on in somebody's life.
You know, you just brought back a memory for me. I went to visit a friend in Southern California, a college friend, and her nephew was with us. So we went to the store, and so we got coloring books. And we all went back and sit on the patio and color. And it was so funny because we had as much of a difficulty getting up from the table as the kids. We looked at each other. We said, this is fun, huh? But
you're
I think there's
right.
something that's on in that process. And I think a lot of parents minimize the benefit of play. They minimize the benefit of artwork and artistry as just, you know, doing nothing and realizing that's a process that goes on that we don't understand, but we need to partake of that. And also the whole issue of our inner child. Speak to the issue of adults who are parenting, but their own inner child is wounded and needs to be a part of this process.
It's so hard because you come with a preconceived idea or expectations. You know, it can be, you know, let's say, and I'll just tell from my own story. I was, you know, because of my past, I became the hypervigilant mom. You know, I was sitting on the street corner watching my kids ride their bike back and forth. I was hovering, you know, the original helicopter mom, just because I was afraid, you know, and that's happens. We're not even conscious as parents what our behavior is based on. You know, we don't take the time necessarily to look at our patterns and figure out, oh, I'm not really reacting to my child. I'm reacting to my inner child, you know, when I don't feel safe or when I feel angry, rather than what's really happening with your own personal, you know, your child at the moment. And I think that's a critical piece that parents are sort of missing right now. I think the other piece is they've blocked their intuitiveness, and that we have to relate in an intuitive, spiritual way from our source and our soul. And I think so much of parenting now is, well, the experts say, the books say, the internet says. Well, sometimes that doesn't work. We have to find out really what's going on inside of us before we can help our children. You know,
exactly.
Not all the answers are there, you know, and nonverbal communication is huge. We have to learn how to read them, read their faces, you know, and what's happening. I helped a family, and this was, the mom had been in a car accident, and the car rolled over, and she had her 10-year-old and her 3-year-old with her. And, you know, they're all banged up and wounded. The 10-year-old won't talk, and the 3-year-old has no words for it. So I said, well, let's make it sort of fun and do it in the kitchen, take it out of the realm of whatever, a conversation. And so they made chocolate pudding, and I suggested, you know, draw stick figures. And then talk about, oh, let's place an M&M where it hurt when we got banged up. What happened when, you know, did you hit your head when the car rolled? You know, all those things. And all of a sudden the kids were giggling and laughing, but they started to talk. And so I think that's the gift of using your intuitiveness because, you know, she kept saying, you know, talking to the therapist is not getting the answers. You know, I can't get them to talk to me. You know, they've shut down. And so this was a mom using her intuition. Let's try a different approach. And so I think that's part of parenting is we've gotten away from our intuition. We don't listen to our gut too often.
Exactly. Now, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and you sort of addressed that through an email, but I was wondering, in your work that you've done with survivors of sexual abuse, have you found there to be a high incidence of people who have had foster care experience or just even separation from their biological parents?
I can't say that. I really don't have that information to tell you. That is not necessarily something that's come up for me. You know, the numbers, unfortunately, you know, as far as prostitutes and things like that, so many of them are in foster care. 75% of prostitutes say they've been sexually abused. So, you know, I can go back and extrapolate from that, but I don't have that personal experience to share.
Okay. Yeah, because I think what happens, you have the guilt and shame of the two separate incidents plus everything that probably brought the child into care, depending on whether or not the abuse took place before or during foster care placement. And there are so many variables to that that cause that whole depression cycle and the shutdown and everything else that comes with it. But I just, because the foster care population is the one that I do most of my work with, I'm just starting to see that it really, the sexual abuse is across the board, regardless of the placement, but I'm just really interested in seeing how much of that is impacted by the experience. And when you speak of parents not being intuitive, a lot of times when you have a surrogate parent, as in a foster parent or especially a group home, there is very little intuition there. As a matter of fact, there's very little emotional connection there to even be tuned into a child to be intuitive enough to sense and be able to respond to that child's need. So that's something that I really would like to share with some of our caregivers, our foster parents and relative caregivers, group home workers who are working with children, because it goes beyond the clinical. And it just annoys me. I believe that everybody is gifted, that God gives everybody a piece of the puzzle to work together. But when it's one-sided and you just deal, you know, with the medicinal, the medical medication aspect of it, you know, the psychiatric, or you just deal with the behavioral and you don't deal with the emotional, you're still leaving out a part of that child's being.
Right. And
I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I've noticed from, you know, survivors, and I would assume a lot of, you know, the foster situations you're talking about, is a sense of loss, you know, loss of themselves, loss of the parent that they wanted, you know. I was just working with this young woman who actually was in foster care, and she, you know, I mean, she says, my whole life is losses. You know, and how do I let go of that? You know, she lost her parents when she was 9, you know, and then she, you know, got sick and she lost her ovaries and then she got this and, you know, it's just been one loss after another. And that has been the prevalent, you know, you ask what other psychological things and emotional things. That has been her message. So the world is not safe. You know, she wants to hang on to everything because she's afraid. What else am I going to lose? So it's like she blocks herself from true happiness. She doesn't go all the way in a relationship. She doesn't go all the way in her job. She just doesn't reach beyond that little comfort zone because she's always afraid she's going to lose it.
So I
can see that same kind of, you know, that's one of the things with parents, you know, when they're not bonding as much, or a foster family or a child even, they're not going to bond in the same way because they've had that extreme loss, you know, and they don't know what to do with that loss. They haven't been able to figure out how to transform it and change the message that there is safety, there is hope, that they won't be that way always, that pain won't always be there.
And I think that's it. People feel like it's never going to change. It's
right.
Never going to change. And giving more than just a sense of hope, because those words mean nothing after a while.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What about men that you've worked with when you do your – because you also do individual work with people, right?
Right, yes.
And
I do a lot of coaching and stuff like that. And, you know, for your audience tonight, I just want to say, if you go to my website, www.raeluskin.net. You can apply for a free strategy session, so that maybe we can work together. I would love to if it's a fit. So I have a questionnaire that I'd like you to fill out so I know a little bit more about you, and then we can have a conversation. So I'm offering that to your listeners tonight.
Wonderful. And I'm putting it up in the chat room as well as it is on our Block Talk announcement and in the
Okay,
Facebook.
And the other gifts that are there is a handout about how they use a little bit about the science of art and how they're using it in the hospitals and things like that. And then I have something called a forgiveness mandala and visualization there, because I think there's such a big need for that for all of us to address forgiveness. You know, you can't have loss and grieving without forgiveness for ourselves, for the people who hurt us, you know, people left us, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's in there as well.
Right. So I was about to ask you, what percentage, approximately, are males that utilize your services, your workshops, your individual sessions?
Right. I have to tell you, though, I usually work with people who have been in therapy already. I don't take people who are beginning, because that's not my specialty. Mine is taking you when you've gotten stuck in therapy. So it is like the next level. I want people who've done some transformational work on their own with a therapist or on their own and have tried different modalities, because this isn't for everybody, and there is a lot of responsibility for yourself in this, you know, that mm-hmm. it takes you to a different place. And so you have to feel that you have to have gotten to a place of some healing already. So.
Mm-hmm.
So the men I've worked with have already gotten there. You know, one of the men I've worked with, you know, was abused by a clergyman, and, you know, and he's done a lot of internal work and you know, for years, but he just needed a little push, you know, to get over that hurdle, you know, where he was stuck in his life.
So would you say it's a very small percentage of men who actually seek out the help?
Well, men are slower to reach out for help. They're embarrassed. There's still the psychology of men don't cry, men don't tell, suck it up. They also get confused depending on the sexuality of the perpetrator. So you have some issues around that. So then they're questioning their own gender
and sexual orientation.
So that becomes an issue, so they don't want to address it. What happens is, I think in parenting and in a relationship is where they see how it impacts them. I think many of the men that I've met, they can focus on their work, they can get their work done, but when they come home at the end of the day, they've built a wall between them and their kids. Oftentimes I've heard stories of men who are unable to really touch their kids because, again, they're scared to death. I'm going to abuse them. Something bad's going to happen. Or, you know, so they keep the kids at a distance. And with their wives, they have trouble explaining stuff. Or if they say something, and I did this to my spouse, I said, I was abused. I gave him about three sentences and never wanted to discuss it again. Well, talk about building a wall and a barrier between your relationships. So I'm real conscious of that, and I think that happens a lot with the men. They don't even want to talk about it. And then when they're forced to, if it comes out, it was no big deal. You know, they really downplay it.
Mm-hmm.
So I behoove them to get help. And they really need it. So many organizations out there. There are specialty groups that Oprah had on a show not too long ago in the last season with 200 men who'd been abused. And
yeah.
There was a therapist there talking about it. And it was a great show. And if nothing else, if you do nothing else tonight and you know you are a man who's been abused, a young man, go watch the show, download it. Oprah has it out there. And it will be eye-opening for you and you will not feel alone. And I think that's what, you know, the numbers, they say 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 guys, by the time they're 18, they'll be sexually abused. The numbers are probably higher because the guys don't come forward.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
30% of people never tell. I mean, never tell a living soul. So you've got millions and millions of people out there who are wounded, who could have so much more in their lives. It's not even about telling in the sense, but it's about you deserve more. You deserve love. You know, you deserve happiness, joy, success, whatever that looks like for you. But so many times it's the guilt and the shame that just keeps them hidden and not going for the life that they deserve.
I couldn't agree with you more. I could not agree with you more. And that's why we're doing what we do. I want to take some time, and I think we're going to have enough time to do all three of them, actually.
All right.
Through three of your exercises and your art from my heart book. I just tell you, I just love this. And actually, our agreement was that we were going to exchange because I had the manuscript from my workbook and was supposed to have completed it by May and you used the word stuck. And I'll share with you another time what that word stuck represents in my life. But when I was looking at yours, I just loved, for one, I love your use of colors. And I guess you had an illustrator, but some of this is your artwork too as well, right?
Correct. Yeah, we did a lot of joint. I say I want this, you do it. So,
and it's just so neat to me, and I love. Oh, the other question I was going to ask you, I love the ethnic diversity that you use
mm-hmm.
in the book. Because it applies to everyone.
Safe.
I'm going to ask you, the populations that you work with, do you see any patterns in terms of the ethnic differences of people who seek the help and those who do not?
Oh.
Well, I guess you wouldn't know if it's not because you don't know. But for those who come to you.
I don't know. I can't answer that because I won't know, you know, who comes to me, who doesn't. You know, there are organizations. I do a lot of work with the faith-based groups and stuff, you know, from my own perspective. And so we've had the same issue come up. Do you want to work with somebody in your own ethnicity and faith-based group or not? Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you don't want anybody to know what's going on in your life. So you seek, mm-hmm. you know, you seek it outside of your world. You know, sometimes you want someone who's going to understand, oh, my God, this is the experience I had, and they can relate. So it's an
mm-hmm.
individual thing, and you have to find the answers for yourself. What is important to you when you're seeking out someone to work with? You know, how can you relate to them? Do they have a story that just like, oh, my God, that's me, or a pain, or, you know, I mean, you have to look. Ask the question, you know, have you ever felt wounded or broken? Is that person going to relate to that, or are they not, you know, that kind of thing.
And the reason I ask, because one, being African-American and being a therapist, when I first started in this field over 20 years ago, there were few therapists and of African-American descent in my area and in his built. But I also realized that in terms of people seeking out therapy, you know, in our culture, it's always been, you know, one, you don't air your dirty laundry outside. And that's not just an ethnic issue. It's a cultural issue depending, you know, by what region and class that you grew up in. But I've found that a lot of people in the African-American community came when it was like there was really no other option but to go. And I'm finding now that, you know, more people voluntarily go. And I have, you know, one friend said, you know, She said, when we were growing up, therapy, Mitchell Christian said, my daughter now thinks it's a privilege. She shows it as a sign of status. Oh, I have to go see my therapist today.
Hey, I love it. That's the way it should be. Instead of, you know, when I grew up, it was a stigma. You know, you know, going to a therapist was just poo-pooed, you know, in my family. So I was like the first one to go, and it was like, that was like, oh, don't talk about it. You know, it was worse than having cancer. Oh, my God, you're going to a therapist, you know. So it was a hush. And so today it's much more out there. And, you know, I sent my own kids to therapy when they needed it and did whatever I had to do and, you know, work with them myself. So, you know, but again, you don't want to treat your own kids.
Oh, this is true. You can't play both. I know that for a fact. But it's just trying to reach all populations. I feel like, you know, I've been blessed to be in a situation where, you know, my role is pretty, you know, multicultural, multi-ethnic, and, you know, they call me the woman, like, with the rainbow tribe.
Okay, that's good.
Mother of African-American sons, and seeing some of the young men that I've had to work with, you know, my thing is, how do I get them to embrace that they are can benefit from and utilize, and I guess just through this call, I just want to put out for whoever's listening that the work that we're talking about is not just for only one group of people. It's for everyone.
It is for everyone.
You go about it, and also based on, you know, what your belief system is. I know a lot of people who've grown up in the Christian community feel like, you know, well, this is going a little bit too far, but I believe that we have to have open minds and keep in mind, you know, that, you know, even the Bible says, you know, we're wonderfully and marvelously made, meaning that, you know, we have very intricate parts of ourselves. And there's more to us than just this physical body. And that's the message that I want to get across so much so, because it's around me every single day.
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, the way you express it is gorgeous. And it is a message that we all need to hear. What resonates, you know, and that we are more than the experience that we've had. I mean, and that's it. You don't need to be stuck in your story forever. You don't have to be in pain forever. You're never, you're really not the victim. You may feel like it, but you have a choice now. How do you want to respond to the situation? And that all takes time. It's a process. And those are the kinds of things I work with people for a long time, because you've got to get from over on, you know, square A to Z to get there, but it can be done. And there are people living exquisite lives who've been in a lot of pain, you know. I mean, that's why you have Amber Alerts. That's why you have Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You know, that's why Eve Ensler started her, organization to protect women and children from abuse around the world, because she experienced it, and she turned it around and made the experience, the transformation in her own life, and gave it back to other people. And I think that's what you're doing every day when you talk to people and putting your heart and soul into the foster system and the kids and the people that you've met. I mean, you've shared that, and you've taken whatever experiences you've had in wounds and made it a gift. And that's what I ask people to do, and think about it, that you all have that. It is there within your taking. And you have to be willing to work at it, though. I wish I could have the miracle and say, it's done, but it usually takes a little more than that.
Well, like I say, my term is heart work, H-A-R-D and H-E-A-R-T.
Very good. Yeah, I'm going to have to use that one, hard work and heart work. I love it.
So, and that's what, you know, that's the title of my book, as well as, you know, the workbook is How is Your Heart Working in the Village? And so that was one of the things as I was going through yours. I was saying, okay, adding some art and a couple of little activities that might enhance it to get people, because I want people to really get involved. I want them to do the work. If you're not willing to go to therapy, if you pick up the book and you can find yourself in there somewhere. And so I'm saying, well, maybe this is, you know, part of the reason. But your book just drew me in.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was written for young people to read and do by themselves, but there's activities for families to do. I think I addressed a lot of the issues, you know, about self-esteem, developing resilience, what's courage, body image. You know, young people go through that. Adults go through that. Everybody's always dealing with body image, you know. How do I fit into society? What makes me unique and special? And about giving back, because I think that's a big part of learning who you are, is about giving back and knowing that you have something, like we talked about earlier, to contribute.
Exactly. And I think the thing about it, people really don't want to do the work. you know, when they talk, they expect that I'll go and I'm supposed to be healed. But it's like when I have people that do make progress with therapy, they say, oh, you've helped me so much. You know, I can't. They're just like, no, you did the work. You took the tools that I gave you and you worked it. Some other people come here and they get the same thing, but they don't get the same results. So
right.
It's being willing to do the work and creating an environment for yourself to do the work. And that's empowering yourself and giving you charge to take control over some of the aspects so you can make the changes. So three of the activities that I want to do from your workbook, there are no page numbers, so I just have to give you the
All right,
one
you want to do scribbles, yeah.
Just to, let me see. Scribbles and doodles. Let's play with scribbles and doodles.
All right. Well, I asked everybody to have paper, pen, or crayons. Hopefully crayons or markers are better. But if you have a pen, don't worry about it. Just use it. I want you to take your pick one color, if you have color, put it in your non-dominant hand, hold your paper with the other hand, close your eyes. How much time do we have? How long does this go? I guess I better ask that first, Evelyn, before.
Well, I figure we could go really another half hour. The call is usually
okay. All right. Well, then rather before I do that, mind if I do a little meditation then? I wasn't sure how much time we had.
Yeah, it's usually an hour, but the broadcast we can take for longer so people can listen to it. So I figure we've talked almost an hour. The next part can be people can come back and listen to the archives and do the experiential part, or they can fast forward to this part and do this part at the end. So I think if we could give each exercise maybe 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay, then let me take you through meditation first, because I feel that is part of this process. So it's easy, you know. I mean, people freak out when they hear creative visualization or meditation. Mine is simple. You know, I may tell you, you know, imagine a dog. And you see a dog, imagine it with a blue ribbon on its, you know, neck. Then imagine it in a box. That's creative visualization. You just did it in your head, you know. You just sort of put the pieces together. But if you don't hear anything and you don't get a visual image as I do this, it's okay. Just sort of listen to the words and allow yourself to go into that place. So plant your feet on the floor. Rest your hands in your lap. Close your eyes. And take a deep breath. Notice how the breath feels. Is it cool or warm as you inhale? With each breath in, imagine the warmth of the sun caressing your cheek, bringing in peace and calm. With each breath out, imagine the tension draining out of your feet into the warm sand. Breathe in and out. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. Breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. Notice how your body feels. Where do you hold your tightness? In your jaw or neck, shoulders or hips? Be aware and breathe into it. Roll your shoulders. Move your head from side to side. Open your mouth. With each breath out, let go. Relax. Let the tension drain out of you. Notice how you're feeling. Are there any changes? Now, on the count of five, I'd like you to open your eyes. One, two, three, four, five. How did you feel, Evelyn?
I felt like I was trying to be still. I felt like a little kid that was trying to just sit in the chair. It's like, okay, don't say anything. You know, just be there. But I felt just a little. When you talk about the warmth, I felt that because we're finally getting some summer weather here. So that felt good. You know,
okay.
Like, okay, I can feel warmth. I can feel the heat, and I'm not cold.
All right. Well, normally I would take this and make it a little longer, probably double the time, you know, but I'm just conscious of time trying to get these three things in. But it's the kind of thing that this is a check-in, and anybody can do this at any point. If you're feeling stressed during the day, sort of just close your eyes and start breathing and check in. Where is the tension in my body? And send, you know, your breath there. You know, just imagine your breath in that part of the tension, and you'll notice that it just sort of eases out, goes down, imagining it going down into the earth and just relaxing into it. So that's what I would say first. Now we'll go back to the crayons. I'd like you to pick up one of your crayons, pick whatever color is your favorite. Okay. Use your non-dominant hand, hold it in that hand. Close your eyes. And with your other hand, hold the paper so you don't, it doesn't get away from you. And now I want you to just scribble. Now, you can't be judging yourself too harshly, and this is what happens. People say, oh, I'm not an artist. I can't draw. I can only draw stick figures. You're drawing with your non-dominant hand. You've got your eyes closed. So how perfect, quote, unquote, can it be? So allow yourself to scribble. Now, if you've been scribbling just with your wrist, imagine using a bigger movement. Imagine it coming from your shoulder. Okay. Great. Now I want you to put that crayon down and pick up a second color and do the exact same thing. You can open your eyes to pick the other color and do your non-dominant hand. Again, close your eyes and scribble. Now, this time, think about being angry. Imagine what anger feels like and looks like. So scribble that into your picture. Allow yourself to go to some place you're just pissed off today. Somebody did something to you, and they cut you off in traffic. They said something nasty. So just scribble, scribble, scribble. Okay, now I'd like you to open your eyes and just look at it for a moment. Is it different when you're calm? What kind of lines or shapes did you use when you were calm?
You want me to tell you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, interestingly enough, my first color, I didn't realize until I opened my eyes that it was dried out because I was using a marker, so it didn't show. The second one is this really, it's cute. It's funny. Actually, I'll have to take a picture of it and paste it up on Facebook.
Okay, do that. I'd love to see it. Yeah.
It looks like a snowman, but also there's a part of it that looks like a lady with a hat, and then underneath there's like, in the bottom of the snowman, there's like one eye that's winked with a little smile, but in the middle, there are these three really dark, intense spots. And interestingly enough, believe it or not, I was not looking. One of them even
looked
like
impressed. You must be some artist to be able to do that. Most people would have a lot of jagged lines. I'm not telling you what to do or how to do it, but if you don't have images, it's perfectly okay, because usually when I ask people to get angry, it becomes a sharp line or a stab at something or a mark on a paper. And so it changes it. So a lot of times you'll have a lot more curvy lines when you're calm and then the other. So you can just sort of see where you are. And I play a game with people when I scribble, and I ask them, what color is calm? What color is sad? Draw sad. It's just a scribble. So that's all you have to do. One of the pieces that I do, and since you brought up all these wonderful images, and I'm going to have people take a few minutes now, is to write down the color that they chose, the first two colors, so it can be blue, green, purple, whatever, and free associate with it. So that means if you think green grass, green money, blue skies, blue water, write down those words on a piece of paper there. Then, when you're, you know, and it, keep going for a few minutes. This is a much long, again, this is a 20-minute exercise. I'm condensing shorter so you get a feel for what you would be doing. Then I want you to write all those images that you just said you saw. You know, so you had a snowman, you had three lines, whatever those are, write all that down. And if yours made you laugh, it made you smile, great. And if somebody else has made them feel good, bad, whatever, write down whatever emotion or word that you would associate with what you scribbled.
Can you repeat that again? Because I got stuck trying to change
okay,
my color.
Okay, where did you laugh? Okay, did you write down all the images that you had mentioned to me?
No, I'm still doing the words that I associate with the color.
Okay, you can keep doing that. But if somebody's beyond
okay.
that, write down whatever words come to you when you look at your picture. Is there an image?
Okay.
Is there something that came up for you? Is there an emotion? If you saw it, you know, one word, was it discordant? Was it harmonious? Was it happy, sad? Whatever words come to you.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Now I want you to take the next 10 minutes. I'll give you 10. And I want you to write once upon a time using all those words. Once upon a time. So I'll start the timer. I don't know if you want to put some music on, Evelyn, for people, so while we do this.
Okay. As a matter of fact, I was planning on lining up some music, so I will, let's see, I'll do this one. Okay, here we go. My mind goes sailing.
Okay, and you come back in when you're done writing, because you're the person I'm speaking to, so.
Okay, well, give me the timer.
Okay, I have 9:06 right now, so 9:16.
Oh, that's a little bit too much. Okay, that's good.
Okay.
Okay.
Actually, I'd like to put in a plug for that song.
Okay, put in a plug. Go for it.
That song is entitled My Mind Goes Searching. It's by a young lady named Kim Ree, who is based out of San Rafael, California, a former foster youth. And that's a cut number 17 from our CD called Friends with Heart, Volume 1, We Are the Village. It was called My Mind Goes Searching. So, if anybody
fabulous.
Is interested, go to our website to find it. So, you want to hear my story?
I would. I'd love to.
Okay. I got a lot of scribble here, so this, I could probably read the picture better than I can read the story. So, using the words. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful woman who liked purple. She wore purple hats. However, her head was filled with expressive thoughts. Magenta was her heart, but there were parts that were hurt. The purple disappeared, and there was a snowman inside. But deep in her belly, there was a wink. She winked still at the world. That's it.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I mean, you can see how deep you can go with this. You know, obviously we didn't spend the time that I would do, because if you're really doing this, you spend time coloring and developing it, and there's all these other pieces to this. But and then the same time with the writing, because part of it then is owning it, creating a title, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's really interesting. I did this workshop for some therapists, actually, and one of the women who is an art therapist had the toughest time sharing her story. She said, I ask my clients to do this every day. But here she was crying when she shared her story, because it was raw. It was, the emotion was there. And this is a great way to deal with emotions. You know, scribble whatever you're feeling, pick the words, the colors that you've chosen, and write about it. And all of a sudden, you'll change how you're feeling. It can't help but change you in some way. So that's what I would suggest to anybody. You can use this at any time when you're sitting at your desk, at school, you got to go take a break, go sit in the bathroom and do it. You know, I mean, it's a great way. I was just at this conference, and I just got this, like, my stomach got tense, and I started drawing. I just scribbled whatever was going on in my body, and it was like, oh, my stomach, my throat, and I knew I had to scream. And here I'm in the middle of a conference with 100 people, so, and there's no safe place to go scream. So I got up, and I went outside. I went into the next room. And I don't know if you're familiar with the lion face in yoga, you know, where you stick out your tongue and you bulge your eyes and you go, you know, and you sort of make that sound. And that was what I had to do, and I felt instantly better. So I learned to trust my instincts by just scribbling them. I scribble, I write, and then I act upon it. And it's a good model, I think, because as you learn to trust yourself, and that's all about healing, is learning to trust yourself and your inner wisdom, that you can all do this. And listen to your gut when you know. If you're in an uncomfortable position, if somebody feels not right to you, they probably isn't right. If they're making advances to you and you need to get out, or if something just doesn't feel right, you're going to learn to honor yourself by doing this process, because it's a check-in for you.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important. Like, I hear people say, oh, I just want to scream. And I said, well, scream then. And I said, well, I can't. And I think one of the things that I've been able to do with kids, you know, when there was a space, to go out and, you know, just play catch with them. And if you go from one end to the other, in order for them to, for you to hear them, they have to scream. And they're letting it out. The energy has to come out. And it's stuck inside. There has to be a way to get it out.
Right, and this is one of those little quieter ways, but I have a funny story about screaming. The first time I had to scream in therapy, you know, I mean, this was like this blood-curdling scream, and so then I'm like, oh, my God, I got to do this more. Well, I lived on the railroad tracks, you know, and I would wait for the train to go by because I was afraid my neighbors would think I was killing my kids, you know, but the minute the train would go by, I'd be screaming at the top of my lungs, and now I suggest roller coasters are always good, too, because it's perfectly acceptable to scream now, not a roller coaster.
But without getting on the roller coaster, can you do that?
If you're
on the ground,
no, just
harder than the people on the bike.
Or scream, it works really well. So,
hey, okay. All right.
Okay. Now, I would say, you know, doodling. We all doodle, you know. I mean, everybody, you sit by phone, you're taking classes, you're making notes, everybody doodles. Something I suggest that people do together is create a doodle story. because I think that's just something that families can do together. It's another way to interact and start a dialogue and sort of find out what's going on. And it's real simple. You just create shapes. You talk about a shape or a line, you know. And so it's not about creating a great piece of artwork. It's making a dot, making a circle. You know, a dot, I mean, is black and colored in, and a circle is just an empty, you know, shape of a circle.
At this right now for people who are just doing more of their own individual work that may not, who might be listening to this and just listening to this alone, that they can do, because I like the one where you say which shapes to use to put this down and to pick up another color.
Hey, we can do that one. That's fine. Do you want me to just do it? I can do it. This is a doodle game. Anybody can play it. So draw a small circle at the top of your page.
Okay.
Now draw a triangle that touches it. Now draw three jelly bean shapes or kidney beans, whatever you like, but most people like jelly beans. Now touch the edge of one of the jelly bean shapes and draw a large curved line that ends on the edge of your paper. So you're going to take it all the way to the edge of one of your, it doesn't matter where.
Okay.
Draw five small little squares on your paper.
Okay.
Now draw a straight line from one corner of your paper to the other.
From one corner to the other. Okay.
Draw a triangle. Now draw two more triangles that touch each other.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to add 10 little dots.
And we're using all the same color for all of these?
No, you're going to color them in or do whatever you want with them. So I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. Yeah, you can use any color you want if you want to do it this way, or you can just color them in when you're done. I usually tell people to color it in when they're done.
Okay. So 10 little dots.
Yep, 10 little dots, and then you color it in. And it's a great way to just sort of interact with your family, have some fun. You learn your shapes when you're really little this way. You can make up stories about it. And what's nice, you can take turns being in charge and being the leader. This is one of those things that it's not parents telling kids what to do. You can reverse the roles. And kids, I think we need to give them opportunities to lead. To be competent, and so they can make up their own, like, you know, whatever their shapes are, and lead their family or the younger kids in this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got our 10 dots.
Mm-hmm. And now I would say just spend some time coloring.
Okay.
And
so
again, I'm sorry, what?
I was going to say, I'll color after we do the phone, after we finish the call. So when we finish, how do we utilize this? What exercise does this, what muscle does this build?
Well, I think that this actually builds, like I was saying, leadership. You ask, how does it feel to lead? How does it feel to follow somebody in their directions? And then when you give the same, and then I think the other thing is we all look different. You know, and we all get the same instructions. We all hear the same thing. But if you line up all these pictures, they're going to look totally different. And I think that's the lesson that we have to learn. We may all look the same on the outside. We may all be given the same direction, but it isn't. You know, we're all individuals. And how we handle our lives as individuals, we can do that. I just think these are just simple examples of the twofold process, really. If it's an inside process that, you know, we can stand tall, we can lead, we can follow. We can also then look at, even with the same opportunities, you know, we can all be artists of our own lives. We can create masterpieces. And it doesn't matter if you've been in foster care. It doesn't matter if you've been abused. It doesn't matter if you have these negative voices running through your head. You can change it. You can make this a masterpiece, just like your drawing is a masterpiece. And each one of those people had the same instructions and same opportunity, and they all look different. And you look different. And that's wonderful. It's allowed, you're allowed.
Yes, and actually I would like to ask if our listeners, if you would be willing to, if you follow these exercises, if you'd be willing to post your pictures on For a Child's Heart Facebook page, and we could have some discussion about that and sharing, you know, what you felt in doing it and realizing. And I think, Ray, that one of the things for this that really resonates for me is how parents really tell our kids, you know, it's my way or no way, and to give these directions to both the kids and the caregivers or parents and see how differently they come, but they follow directions and
right.
realize how different the outcome can still look, and that we all are unique in our perceptions and how we put it there. Because a lot of times the kids say, well, you said to put two triangles together. Yeah, but I didn't mean like that. So
right.
actually,
that's a great right input, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, our listeners.
It is. It's a wonderful analogy for parenting, you know. Mm-hmm. How many times, and then you get mad at your kid because it didn't do it like you thought. But that's you reacting
mm-hmm.
to the message of this is the way it should be. Because we all come away with our own rules and our own vision of things, and it's not, and we don't always communicate it well, and then every person takes it in differently.
Right.
Oh, that was great.
We have less than 10 minutes left. I can't believe the time has gone by so quickly. And I wanted to do the music one, and it's interesting because I used a song that I wasn't actually prepared to use a song for the first activity, but what I wanted to do, I wanted to do musical songs, to do the scribbling or the doodling to different speeds
mm-hmm.
of songs, different
yeah.
instrumental versus vocal, and to see how the difference in our work came out, because I think when we look at how music even impacts our mood or our activity and energy, it's very interesting, and that's what I wanted to do with that. So I'm not sure if we have enough time for me to just sort of...
I think, you know what, I would take the time and put on a slow piece and maybe a faster pace and just sort of let people scribble to them, and then we'll talk about it. So just put them on for if you have something that's sort of slower and then one that's much more, you know, intense kind of thing or upbeat.
Okay. Dominant hand or non-dominant hand?
This one, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
You know, you could be a conductor and do it with both hands. How's that? We're going to do it something different.
I like that. I like that. Well, we're going to start off number 16, which is called Guardian Angel, and then we're going to jump up to a more upbeat one called Gotta Believe, all from the Friends with Heart, We're the Village CD. And here we go. Can you hear that okay?
Mm-hmm, I can hear it.
Eyes open or closed?
Oh, no, this eyes open today. This is more about allowing yourself to get into the music. You know, if you want to, you can.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe now, what I just want to ask you, what kind of marks did you make on your paper? Did they seem, did you have any difference from what you scribbled before? Did you notice anything different?
They were more curvy. They were broader.
Mm-hmm.
They covered the whole page.
Mm-hmm.
And they just flowed. It was just like a flow. And everything was like curly.
Okay, good. I mean, that's everybody's got to find what music sends their heart into that place of calm, because music in itself is healing, you know, and dancing is healing. And what I'm going to suggest is, if you turn up the upbeat music, then is you can dance while you do this. Get your body up and moving, you know, while you're doing the scribbles. You know, a lot of times I'd say get a big piece of paper and, you know, put it up on the wall, you know, because that just really. Oh, it's a great experience. So,
hey, and we may not have time to process this throughout the recording, because the recording may stop, but we can continue our conversation and somehow we can convey that to the listening audience. So if our listening audience who are listening to the archives, if you get cut off during these last 5 minutes, come to our page and find out what the outcome of it was. Ray, will you give listeners your contact information one more time, please?
Okay, it's www.rae.luskin, L-U-S as in Sam, K-I-N, .net. And please come to my website. There's some free handouts in there, some gifts for you, and there's an opportunity to have a free consultation strategy session with me. You've got to apply, and I look forward to hearing from you. And if you have any questions, you can just write it on my contact information there, and I'd be happy to answer them. I've enjoyed so much spending time with you, Evelyn, and this discussion has been wonderful. And you bring so much to the table, and I learned from you. So I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, and I really do look forward to collaborating at some point, because I love what you're doing. So for our audience, please go to our Facebook page or email us at heart@fourchildsheart.org. And now the song is Gotta Believe, and we hope that you enjoy it. And I'm going to be dancing, and when this recording ends, Ray and I are going to talk some more. Here we go.
Right.
Gotta Believe.
On the line waiting for you, Evelyn, okay?
It out without going to the end. So we actually have, 1 minute and 45 seconds left.
Oh, my. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I enjoyed this so much. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I really, your energy, you came right up to the top over there, girl.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you for bringing it out. And that's when we know that we're living our passion, when we can come from a place that doesn't feel so energetic or purposeful and come straight into the heart of the matter. And I just want you to know that my second drawing,
yeah,
I have seconds. All I say, it's off the hook.
Is it? All right.
So I will talk to you shortly after this recording ends because we're going to be cut off. Everybody have a wonderful week. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks on, well, 3 weeks, Heart Talk with Miss E on the second Wednesday in September, which will be Wednesday, September 14th. And our special guest that week will be Mr. Derek Clark, the Never Give Up guy. Take care, everybody. God bless.
Hello? Hey, Evelyn, are you there?
Yeah, I was trying to let it drown out because it was going to end.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to edit that off out the tape. Hold on.
Okay.